Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to Science Faction, the only show where a scientist, a comedian, and a comedian scientist come together to discuss science comedically.
Hello, and welcome to Science Faction 502. Science Faction, your weekly corona update. The numbers are as follows for today, October 27th, 2020, worldwide infected, 43,775,000. Worldwide deaths, 1,165,000. U.S. infected, just under 9 million. U.S. deaths, 231,000. All right, let's jump right into the articles for this week. A very good takedown of the idea of herd immunity was published in Nature this week. And I think it gets to the heart of the issue. So you've probably heard the term herd immunity. What does it mean? Well, herd immunity is when enough of a population gets immune to a specific virus. Maybe that's natural immunity, maybe that's vaccinated immunity, or maybe that's they've caught it and gotten over it and now they have immunity. But enough of the population gets immune to a specific disease so that that disease cannot spread around through the population anymore. So in terms of COVID, an example that seems to be used a lot is the Brazilian city of Manaus. And this was a really, really bad infection rate. This was a place, it's a city of about 2 million, so it's a decent sized city. And it spread like wildfire through there. 66% of the people in that city are believed to have caught and been infected by it. That is based on follow-up research later on in terms of looking for antibodies. And now that city does not seem to have a lot of COVID going around as much. And so the idea is, hey, look, they got it. They got herd immunity. Maybe other cities should go about this as well. Obviously, you might have also heard about this in reference to Sweden, though we're going to get to that in a bit because they weren't pursuing the herd immunity that a lot of people think they were. So first, let's talk about how we get to herd immunity. What's the number? Is it 66%? Like, what is it? The fact is, no, it actually depends on a variable. So we've talked before about rho, which is the variable that they use in epidemiology to describe how many people one person will infect. So like a rho of one, you're infecting one. Anything over that, you're infecting more than one. So maybe it's three. High ones like measles, you're infecting a lot of people, so they have a high rho. So there's a mathematical formula, which is one minus one divided by rho. And so what that means is the rho will determine what your herd immunity number is. Now it gets even more complicated because rho differs from place to place for the same disease very widely. In fact, a recent published work on all the different rho numbers of COVID from different countries, if you plug all those different ones in, you get numbers of what percent of the population needs to have gotten sick for us to get to herd immunity. It goes anywhere from 85% to 5% based on those different rows. So it's difficult to tell. And the problem is those rows, meaning the amount of people each person infects, is socially dependent. It's not like there's a bunch of different viruses that are vastly different in all these different countries. They just have different policies and different interactions and different social structures and stuff. So they have an effective different row, but they all have basically the same virus, small mutations, but the same virus. It gets even more complicated because actually that formula I gave you, 1 minus 1 divided by rho, is actually a little different. If you want to do it right, it's 1 minus 1 divided by rho effective, where rho itself is actually constantly changing within a population because as more people become immune after getting infected, that rho number changes because then you can infect less people. So the rho, even in the same society for the same disease, later on will likely be smaller, depending on, I mean, I guess some social things can change, but likely be smaller later on than earlier on because there's less people available to infect, so the rho goes down. So obviously this is a complex thing. This is more of a gradient than a number, even though this formula spits out a specific number. And something to remember is even when you hit that number, it's not like it's some magic button like, boom, whoa, look, 66 or whatever percentage of the population got it. Now nobody else can get sick. In reality, you still have transmissions and local outbreaks, and the row of one big group might be deceptive because there might be smaller groups within it that have a much higher one, et cetera, et cetera. So all of that is to say this is a very complex thing that you can't really narrow down and say if 40% of the people in any given country get this disease, and all of a sudden we are going to reach herd immunity and nobody else is going to get it. What we do know is that in a place like the US, if we wanted to do this, we would be looking at a minimum of 1 to 2 million deaths. So when you see these politicians saying, like, we should strive for herd immunity, it's like, bro, are you saying we should kill 2 million people? Are you a third Hitler? Like, what does that mean? It's it's interesting, too, because it's not something that we don't understand the transmission rates for. I mean, what they should be saying is we should all wear masks. We should all social distance. We know how to prevent this virus from transmitting from one person to another. So this idea that the easier route is just to infect everybody is crazy. Now, I could see this concept if you were doing like a theoretical framework. If you had too much weed and a bunch of college sophomores sitting around in a dorm somewhere and they're trying to figure it out and they're like, well, what if all of the kids go out and get infected? Because we tend to have really high percentages of mild to moderate symptoms. So all the kids with good intact immune systems, we all go out to like a big chickenpox party. We all get infected and we stay away from old people and immunocompromised people for a while. And then we could become the barrier that keeps it from spreading. Great. That's a great theoretical framework. But the reality of the situation is those people are going to come into contact with older people. And all it takes is one person to contact with one person in one nursing home for us to all of a sudden kill up 50 people, right? And so I understand the impetus. I understand the idea. I could even see the logical reality of you know, postulating these hypothetical situations. But the reality of the world we live in is that we're all intermingled. We don't have some special thing where we're like, guess what? No old people will be here and no immunocompromised. Oh, and by the way, a lot of people don't realize that they're susceptible to this disease because they don't know they have pre-existing conditions like a heart condition that would end up killing them if they got this disease. They're a healthy young person. We saw this with some NCAA athletes that we covered a few weeks ago. Now, a lot of times when U.S. politicians are talking about this, they bring up Sweden's plan, which they say, look, they were going for herd immunity. First of all, they weren't. Sweden has said this outright. They're like, stop saying this. We didn't go for herd immunity. We didn't shut down, but we emphasized PPE and social distancing and all of the stuff that we're supposed to do. And by the way, Sweden failed badly. Their refusal to shut everything down ended up being a horrible decision. They had 10 times the death rate per 100,000 people as their Norwegian neighbors, who most likely had almost the exact same, if not similar, strains of the virus and everything else, and they're very culturally similar and everything. They fucked up. Like, their tactic was wrong, and they have since revised it and said, whoops, this was a mistake, let's go back, and shit, we killed a lot of people for no reason. But I can understand why it's an attractive idea, because the idea is, if we did that, look, the society can get going again, we could protect the weak, and everybody else can get going, and we can move everything along. That is a great theoretical framework, and it is just not a realistic one. I wish it was. I'd love to get back to stuff, too. But if you look at the numbers and the science behind it, and this Nature paper is a great takedown of it, you can see that it's just not real. We're living in fantasy land until we get to the point where we can actually vaccinate people to get to that herd immunity, because then we don't have the mortality risk. Once we get there, then the idea of herd immunity becomes not only attractive, but real and the right thing to pursue. Just a reminder, too, that even if everybody did that, let's say we did our theoretical framework and everybody got all the young, healthy people got sick and we somehow managed to isolate the old and the immunocompromised, even though they didn't know they were immunocompromised and all the people could die. Let's say we did it perfectly. Remember, as we covered a few weeks ago, we have discovered that reinfection is possible. Some non-zero number of people who get the virus are susceptible to getting it again, and at least in some of these cases, the second time is much worse. So we might not even actually be able to reach herd immunity just by getting sick, because our bodies seem to be able, at least some people's, to be reinfected by this virus later on. And one more thing, remember, as we covered before, both with those NCAA athletes and with other people, we actually don't know that just because you don't die from the virus doesn't mean it doesn't have long-lasting effects. We saw very serious organ damage in a high percentage of people who had mild to moderate symptoms, meaning even all those young, healthy people might actually be getting organ damage that kills off some of their kidneys, you know, 10 years later or something like that. So it might be that even trying to do this in young, healthy populations would lead to devastating effects down the road. All right, article number 2, what's up with bat scientists? This is a little bit more lighthearted. I love this article because it was something I hadn't even thought of, but is totally legitimate. So what's going on right now with bat field researchers is they're one of the few field researchers who can't keep going and doing their work. You know, some of us got to go out and still go to archaeological sites and stuff if we were by ourselves. The bat scientists can't because they're afraid of infecting bat populations here in North America with this virus. And this applies to other places as well. But the idea is, listen, this disease came at some point through bats. Once bats get disease, they go through their colonies like crazy because there's millions of individuals in one cave and they obviously don't social distance or wear masks. And normally bats don't actually get sick from their viruses, so we don't think it would kill them. It could, but we don't think it would kill them, but it could go in there, become a petri dish, mutate, and then pop back out as another SARS-CoV-3, you know, and then like do some real damage again. And so these bat researchers have to go to amazing lengths not to get this disease into, you know, North American bat populations. And they do that by wearing Tyvek suits and masks. And they've actually switched to having a lot of their stuff done remotely. So instead of sitting there and surveying bats, they're putting up cameras. Instead of listening for what they're chirping, they're putting up automated microphones and doing analysis on guano when the bats are no longer in the cave so they can see what they're eating as opposed to directly watching them. They're just like, they're finding all of these roundabouts to keep studying bats without the possibility of infecting them. And I just love the idea that like bat researchers are more concerned with bats than a lot of dumb Americans are with our older people. Like they're like bat researchers are like, oh, we should watch out for the bats. And then like rednecks are like, fuck the old people. All right. And lastly, article number 3, why COVID looks like it might be worse this winter. This is also from Nature. And it just overviews a couple of the things that might cause COVID-2 to be very bad this winter, as it seems to be kicking up. Now, one of the things is just in the US and actually in Europe too, so we're not the only dummies here, numbers are skyrocketing. And that has to do with a lot of things. That has to do with that COVID fatigue I was talking about, where people have gotten tired of social distancing and masks. This has to do with a casual attitude towards it. This has to do with political anti-masking movements. This has to do with the Sturgis bike route. This has to do with a lot of things, right? But as we get into winter, we expect this to get worse. Now, not necessarily overall numbers, but infection rates and stuff like that, because respiratory diseases in the winter tend to be much worse. For one, people are congregated inside. Things like heating will circulate air within individual buildings so that one person is in the same air network as a lot of other people, whereas maybe in the fall or the spring, that heating wouldn't be used as much. A lot of viruses tend to like colder, drier air transmission that tends to keep them alive longer, which gives them a longer infection rate in any given place. And again, like right now, in the United States, we have the highest infected rate we have had this entire time. Higher than when it first came, higher than that big peak in, you know, March, April, higher than all of that. We have beaten it. We're like, we're number one. We're at 85,000, something like that, and growing with no sign of deflating. So not only are we going into conditions that are more likely to spread the virus, but we already have way more petri dishes sitting out waiting to infect people. So we should expect that this will be a very, very hard winter. And to be honest, even though we know about that stuff with viruses and cold, dry air, people have been studying this with the flu for decades, and we're still not 100% sure why the flu peaks in winter. We know that, you know, like I said, cold, dry air, people inside and stuff. That doesn't explain all of it, because there are areas, like we're here in San Diego, it doesn't get that cold here. There are places near the tropics, it doesn't get that cold there, but still it tends to follow that general rule that it peaks in winter. So we're not 100% sure why that is, and we're probably not going to find it out with this virus because we haven't figured it out with the flu for the past, you know, couple decades. But we do know that that tends to be a trend with respiratory viruses. And so, I don't know, stay safe this winter, guys. Wear your masks, social distance, be really diligent, and test as often as you are able to, given your resources and finances and abilities and access, and do your best. Because remember, as I've said this before, and I don't think I've said this recently enough, you have the ability to save lives, and you will probably never even know it. Because you not catching this disease and not being a vector to pass it on to somebody else will save lives. It doesn't matter that it's not your nana or, you know, your dad or, you know, maybe even your kid or something, or somebody in your family. It will probably be 2 or 3 links down the chain. It'll probably be somebody you don't even know. Somebody passed the person you infected on the street and they got sick and then they took it to a nursing home or something like that. What I am saying is your ability to A, not catch this, and then B, unfortunately, if you do catch it, to then not transmit it to other people, is going to save lives. And it will be lives you never see. You'll never be heralded. We won't be putting a medal around your neck, but you will still be saving lives. Socially distancing, wearing masks, and not being a chain in this infection will be you saving lives. And given the current situation we're in, this may be the biggest chance you have to save lives in your entire life. I mean, if you're not a researcher who's coming up with the next great vaccine to, you know, stop the flu or something like this, this might be the biggest chance you have in your individual life to save other human beings' lives. Keep that in mind next time you realize how uncomfortable the mask is, or how much you want to go out and see your friends or all that. This is literally your chance to save lives. I hope you do it. Good luck to all you guys out there. Try not to get infected. Stay safe. Can't wait to see you again for Science Faction 503.
You've been listening to Science Faction. Wait, that's not right.